biggest worry is to put money in people's pockets in the immediate time frame if they're currently obviously not working or not receiving a paycheck.
The state starts processing unemployment claims for federal workers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska tribes express concern over the shutdown.
This is an actual need. It's not something that if we have the money, we'll fund it. But this is literally a need in our communities.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It's been 1 week since the federal government shut down. The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development expects a rise in federal workers filing for unemployment payments due to the furlough. KTOO's Lisa Fu has this report.
The Department of Labor started receiving calls from furloughed federal workers the first day of the shutdown. They had these types of questions.
Am I eligible for unemployment insurance? How much can I get?
That's Virginia Calloway, acting chief of unemployment insurance for the state. Last week, the department put out a news release explaining how furloughed federal workers can file for unemployment compensation.
This is a very uncertain time about what's going on with the federal funds, and I know it's making people anxious, and we're here to try to help.
Depending on how long the furlough lasts and if individual claims meet eligibility, the state would pay furloughed federal workers from the Unemployment Insurance Fund, then bill the federal government for reimbursement after the quarter ends December 31st. If federal workers receive unemployment benefits, then are paid retroactively for the time they were furloughed, Calloway says it's unclear if they would have to repay those benefits.
That's a question that is up in the air, but unfortunately, we can't ask the federal government because they're closed.
Our position would be to pay them as long as they're eligible at the time.
That's Lennon Weller. He's in charge of managing Alaska's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund.
Later on, you know, if the situation becomes that they end up getting retroactively paid for those weeks, then that's not for us to determine at this point. I think our biggest, you know, worry is to obviously put money in people's pockets in the immediate time frame if they're currently obviously not working or not able to work and aren't receiving a paycheck.
Weller says he doesn't know how many federal workers have filed for unemployment insurance since the government shut down, but he expects it will be higher than normal.
It's looking like the latest tallies that are coming in, which of course would be just activity that's happened in the last day or two, does seem to be indicating a significant bump in demand, at least for the federal workforce or ex-federal workforce.
Weller says the maximum weekly unemployment payment is $370, not including dependents. If the furlough continues, the earliest payment for a federal worker who filed last week would be October 15th. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska Native tribal governments are keeping their doors open during the shutdown, but worry about how long it will go on. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
So now with the shutdown, we won't even get our payment until, you know, Lord knows when.
That's Richard Peterson, tribal administrator for the organized village of Kasan in southeast Alaska. He says the Bureau of Indian Affairs had to recalculate payments to tribes to comply with across-the-board budget cuts or sequestration. Then it was shut down. He says that's put the BIA 10 months behind in payments to support his tribe's operations. He's worried about how much longer it can keep normal operations going. Here's his response when asked if the shutdown might lead to tribal employee layoffs.
Right now, I don't know. I'm not even comfortable trying to answer that until we really sit down and take a hard look where we're at, you know, depending on how long this goes on and deciding whether or not we want to look at financing options or what have you. I just know that it puts us in a serious bind.
The BIA provides funding to tribes for a wide range of programs, including disaster relief, roads, and tribal courts. Gloria O'Neill is president and CEO of Cook Inlet Tribal Council in South Central Alaska. She says CITC's general assistance program is underfunded and normally runs out of money halfway into the fiscal year. But she says the infusion that normally comes with the start of the new fiscal year on October 1st is missing.
Because of our preparation, we are continuing with service as usual throughout the organization. However, we have a couple of limited service interruptions, one being general assistance. That program is funded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and we have not received our funding for general assistance this year.
O'Neill says CITC is routing people eligible for general assistance to other aid programs. She says education funding is also affected by the shutdown.
We have funding on hand, and so we really try to be careful to ensure that we can meet those obligations and get those scholarships out the door, because, you know, our kids are in school and they need to see that money.
O'Neill says funding to tribes shouldn't be treated as discretionary.
We should be more of a program like Defense or some of the others that really take into account that this is an actual need. It's not something that if we have the money, we'll fund it. But this is literally a need in our communities, and it is based upon treaty obligations.
Tribes also rely on funding from other federal agencies in the U.S. Department of Interior and in the Departments of Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Education, Justice, and Agriculture. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Energy and the challenges of providing it in remote Western Alaska was the main topic of a summit in Bethel yesterday. Tribal leaders from dozens of villages throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta attended the gathering put on by the Association of Village Council Presidents. Angela Denning-Barnes reports from KYUK in Bethel.
It's fall in the YK Delta and temperatures have been bouncing around the freezing mark. But winter is coming, and the elders say it could be a cold one. Tuksuk Bay Elder Paul John told the audience that traditional Yupik teachings include information on how to survive in the harsh environment. John McIntyre with AVCP has heard elders say that the earth is busy insulating itself and preparing for the cold weather that's ahead.
And in some of those villages, I've heard grass growing up to 5 feet tall. And the leaves, you know, this summer when I look at the trees that were growing, the leaves were even bigger. With those kind of indications, we need to start now to look at our energy need.
McIntyre works with the TANF program, or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. He says this past spring, cold weather lasted through May, and families were running out of heating fuel. One family had 11 people sharing a single small home.
And they didn't have fuel oil for 2 months.
AVCP only learned of the family's struggles after visiting the village and running into one of the elders who was staying at the house. In this particular case, one of the children in the home qualified for services, and the whole household benefited from the heating assistance. McIntyre implored the tribal leaders to share that kind of information with AVCP.
You know who needs help. Once you know who needs help, let us know, because we can provide these kind of services to our people that are not making it.
AVCP's Energy Summit precedes the association's annual convention, which happens this week in Bethel. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans express growing frustration with the federal health insurance marketplace.
We have people who are on salary, we have expenses, and we have no way to, at this point, make this a successful business model.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm crossing.
The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The main groups working to help Alaskans sign up for health insurance on the federally run marketplace haven't successfully enrolled anyone. 1 week after the launch of the marketplace, it's still not working correctly. APRN's Annie Feit sat down with Alaskans trying to sign up for insurance on the site and has this story.
It's 8 a.m. and Joshua Weinstein is doing something that has become a familiar routine over the last week. He's trying to log on to Alaska's health insurance marketplace.
So obviously start at healthcare.gov, and let's see if it's going to put me in line or let me log in. This is looking optimistic.
Weinstein is a benefits consultant at Enroll Alaska, the company that's deploying insurance agents around the state to sign people up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. He's attempted to log on to the marketplace at least a dozen times over the last week. He successfully created an account, but hasn't gotten much farther. And on this morning, his optimism quickly fades as he lands on a screen that's mostly blank except for a small blue person icon near the top.
I'm not sure what these are. Can you kind of get the sense of what's going on? I'll click the little person's head and see what happens.
That click doesn't go anywhere, and Weinstein says that's why he isn't walking actual clients through the process just yet.
So this is not a very confidence-boosting experience, and for me or any of our agents to be sitting across from someone at a healthcare facility or a retail location doing this sort of clicking around would be, it'd be nonsensical.
In the meantime, Weinstein is helping clients choose an insurance plan and figure out what subsidies they may qualify for. But actually enrolling in a plan will have to wait until the federal website is functioning. Enroll Alaska says it has a backlog of 1,200 Alaskans who are ready to sign up for insurance. Weinstein says he didn't expect the first week to be perfectly smooth, but it has been discouraging.
We have people who are on salary. We have expenses, and we have no way to, at this point, help people get enrolled and make this a successful business model.
Enroll Alaska intends to have 24 insurance agents in communities across the state, but the company is waiting to deploy most of those agents until the website is working. Tyann Bowling is COO of Enroll Alaska. She says the high initial demand for coverage in the state is encouraging, but she worries that if the marketplace isn't working soon, that enthusiasm will drop off.
And we really don't want that to happen. We're hoping that by the end of this week, we're hoping tomorrow it'll be going. It's all determined on when the federal government can get it functioning.
The federal government doesn't have an estimate for when that will be. Susan Johnson is regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She can't say if anyone from Alaska has successfully enrolled. She says technical problems are affecting all of the federally run marketplaces in 36 states.
We're making improvements every day, but we're not where we want it to be yet. We're adding both hardware and software improvements, and we know it's frustrating. We're working as hard as we can to get to where we all need it to be.
Johnson says there's no hurry to sign up for insurance. She's asking for patience. And at least one Alaskan who's eager to buy new insurance is okay with that. Alex Kruver is a 28-year-old who has asthma. He already has health insurance, but he expects to save money on the marketplace. He's logged on to healthcare.gov 3 times over the last week. He hasn't been able to create a user account. That's left him a bit perplexed, but not too concerned.
I guess I thought it'd be fixed by now.
So how frustrated are you?
Not that frustrated, I think. I mean, it's kind of a bummer, but not very frustrated.
Kruver says the website problems won't deter him at all. He's content to wait, as long as he's eventually able to sign up for a plan that starts January 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The company contracted with the state to manage Alaska's new online medical records database is defending its privacy protections. The Alaska eHealth Network, like many across the country, resulted from state and federal mandates designed to improve efficiency and privacy of health information transfer. It was piloted in Fairbanks and went live this summer statewide. Alaskans are required to opt out of the system if they don't want their medical records in the database. The American Civil Liberties Union is critical of that and has also raised concerns about access by hackers and government agencies. Alaska eHealth Network Executive Director Rebecca Madison acknowledges there are issues with electronic transfer, but says precautions have been taken.
We use the most secure protocols that we can. We ensure that everything is encrypted. We store no data clinically in a place where the demographic data is stored so that they travel in two different streams and they meet up only when the doctor has a clinical viewer to view that. So even if the encrypted data were intercepted at some position, it would only be the clinical or it would only be the demographic. They're never together except on the doctor's desktop when he's reviewing the data.
Madison says, as with electronic transfer of financial information, there's always a chance that people with malicious intent can hack in and try to access data, but it's better protected than the system it's replacing.
It's much more secure than the paper records we used to have that were sent around by mail and by fax. There were many more ways to intercept that data.
Madison also points out the online system's advantage of providing doctors immediate access to health records. She advises people to weigh the risks and benefits in deciding whether or not to participate. The Alaska eHealth Network is overseen by a public work group, and its operation is governed by state law. Former Fairbanks Senator Joe Pascavan advanced the Alaska Healthcare Privacy and Security Bill when he was in the legislature.
Because my primary belief is that it both saves lives and it will save money.
Pascavan says he understands there are concerns about privacy coming from the public, but assures that security was a major focus of legislators.
First of all, there would be an electronic fingerprint that if someone is trying to access your electronic records, there will be the ability to track who that was, when that occurred. Where currently now, if you have a paper record at a clinic, how do you know that people that are working for the clinic or a hospital don't access your records, right now? And there is no fingerprint on that.
Pascavan argues that the system's safety is similar to electronic banking protections and emphasizes it's enforced on companies like the Alaska eHealth Network. Healthcare providers that do not move to the electronic record system will face penalties.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Many Alaskans are choosing to make energy efficiency improvements around their homes. Investing in efficient light bulbs or a programmable thermostat could save hundreds annually. For more tips on how to save money and energy, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
In November, voters in the small city of SeaTac will decide whether to set one of the highest minimum wages in the country. The controversial Proposition 1 would raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour for some workers, including ground crew at the airport. Alaska Airlines is fighting the measure. Traditionally, when workers want better wages, they join a union. So why are airport workers taking this approach instead? As KPLU's Ashley Gross explains, they don't have a lot of choices. They're stuck in a legal limbo under federal labor law.
To tell this story, I'm going to introduce you to someone.
Socrates, tell me your last name.
Bravo.
Bravo, okay. And how old are you?
I am 24.
It's just before dawn, 5:45 a.m. Socrates Bravo is in his apartment in SeaTac, getting ready to go to work.
How long are you going to work today?
Till 10:30.
10:30 at night.
10:30 at night.
If you fly on Alaska Airlines, Bravo may be that guy lifting your suitcase off the plane. He doesn't work for Alaska directly. He works for a subcontractor called Menzies Aviation. He gets $11.25 an hour after working there 2 years. So to get by, he works a lot of overtime. Today, he's working 15 hours.
Well, bedrooms are kind of pretty messy.
This bare-bones apartment that he shares with another guy costs him $400 a month. On his wall is a poster of Che Guevara. But before you start thinking he's some stereotypical class warrior, he's more complicated. He's earning his bachelor's and would like to become a DEA agent. He drives a used Mercedes. He's also a dad.
How old is your daughter?
She's 11 months right now.
His daughter lives with her mom, but Socrates pays for a lot of baby stuff. He scoops up some change to buy snacks at the airport and heads out to catch his bus. Socrates would like a raise. He'd like to not have to work so many hours. So why not just join a union and bargain for that?
Well, it would be nice if we were able to join a union, but since the circumstances are the way they are, it's kind of hard to join one.
To understand why it's hard, you have to stick with me for a teeny little lesson about U.S. labor law. I promise, tiny. But this is important for all of us because it shows how our labor laws, written almost a century ago, are letting people slip through the cracks. In 1926, Marilyn Monroe is born, Winnie the Pooh is published, and in the U.S., the Railway Labor Act becomes law. For a quick tutorial, I turned to Orrin Baird. He's a lawyer with the Service Employees International Union.
The statute was actually written because of concern about strikes and interruption of transportation.
The Railway Labor Act is even older than the National Labor Relations Act. That's the law that covers, say, Boeing machinists or a GM factory worker. But a whole different set of rules apply to railroad workers, and those were later extended to airline workers. They have a higher bar for unionization. They have to organize across the country, not just in one city. Baird says that makes sense for pilots or flight attendants, but less sense for subcontractors like Socrates Bravo.
The flight attendants fly in between Seattle and Houston, and some are based in Houston and some are based in Seattle. And they have the same basic wages and working conditions. These contractors, it varies from airport to airport and then from airline to airline.
Baird says baggage handlers like Bravo don't ever see their counterparts in other cities.
Basically, it's almost impossible for these workers to organize a union because they have no idea where the other workers are.
So now there's a legal tussle going on between SEIU and Menzies over which law should apply to these workers. I wanted to talk with Menzies about this, so I emailed their top executives in the UK asking for an interview. They said they wouldn't do one. But Menzies Vice President Philip Harnden wrote that they don't believe the workers are in a legal gray area and that Menzies workers fall under the Railway Labor Act. So while all this plays out behind the scenes, whether Socrates Bravo gets a raise depends on people like this.
My name is Evelyn Kittredge and I'm a voter in SeaTac.
I caught Kittredge outside a Safeway near SeaTac Airport. She's torn. On the one hand, she thinks there wouldn't be enough work because everyone would want to move to SeaTac. On the other hand, her own daughter worked minimum wage for a very long time.
It was hard to see her struggle.
Washington State already has the highest minimum wage in the country, $9.19 an hour. But initiative supporters say that still leaves workers in poverty.
You can pick up your oversized items between carousels 15 and 60. Thanks for flying Alaska Airlines. Have a good night.
It's 10:30 p.m. and weary travelers are picking up their suitcases. Socrates Bravo is weary too. He's just getting off work after a long day.
So what do you do when you get off after a 15-hour work day?
So right now, I was thinking of going to Safeway, buy some hamburger meat, and make some spaghetti.
Then he'll go to bed and get up at 5 a.m. for another 15-hour work day. Bravo says if he had a raise, he could spend more time with his daughter. But opponents argue companies will have to cut jobs if their labor costs go up. To Bravo, it's about fairness. Big companies like Menzies and Alaska Airlines make millions of dollars.
It's absurd how people who make minimum wage aren't able to get at least a little bit of that pie.
Now something that could have maybe been hashed out at the bargaining table between a union and the employer is up for SeaTac voters to decide. It's in their hands whether Socrates Bravo gets a raise. Ashley Gross.
Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority and Catholic Community Services yesterday announced the expansion of a program that helps senior citizens live independently in Southeast Alaska. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
For the past 5 years, the Tlingit and Haida Regional Housing Authority has received federal funds for an elder service coordinator on Prince of Wales Island. This year, two new communities will be included in the program, which helps seniors access things like health care, financial information, events, and activities.
Programs like gardening, language classes, storytelling, or cultural events.
Ricardo Worrell is chief executive officer of the Housing Authority. He says additional grant money will be used to hire coordinators in Yakutat and Saxman, where Tlingit and Haida recently opened new senior centers.
A lot of our tenants in these senior housing facilities have spent their entire lives in that community, and they want to remain there. Their family lives there. Their grandchildren live there.
The Housing Authority contracts with Catholic Community Service to run the program. Marianne Mills is director of Southeast Senior Services for CCS, which operates similar programs in Juneau and the entire region.
The main thing is to keep them active, healthy, connected with other people, and not just staying in their place by themselves.
Mills says the elder service coordinators in Yakutat and Saxman will tailor activities to the needs of their communities. She says the program on Prince of Wales has benefited from partnerships with other agencies.
For example, with the Search Clinic, they did a Fit and Be Fit class, got some exercise equipment in the senior apartments there, and arranged for doctor and physical therapy visits on a regular basis. Just made a variety of different health promotion activities available.
Tlingit and Haida this year received a total of $246,000 for elder service coordinators from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The money is part of HUD's Resident Opportunities and Self-Sufficiency Grant Program. Despite the federal shutdown and sequestration budget cuts, Worrell says he's fairly confident the money will continue to be available.
If they don't have programs that allow our elders to age in place in the rural communities, it's going to be even more expensive to bring them to our urban centers where it's a lot more competitive. The wait lists to get into these senior housing and health care programs are tremendous.
He says the Housing Authority will just need to remain diligent in communicating to Alaska's congressional delegation the importance of such programs. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lisa Fu and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ashley Gross in Seattle. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.